Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is October 31st. Happy Halloween. We are talking in obscurity, companion podcast to writing in obscurity. My name is Kevin Carlson, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
And we are talking about Michael McDowell's The Elementals on this Hallows Eve.
I will say, this book, perfectly appropriate for Halloween.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is with this podcast where we either listen to really or read really downer books or we read things that are just kind of horrifying. And this manages to be both.
Yeah. I mean, stick to our brand. Stick to the brand here.
Yeah, you got to stick to the brand. That's true.
I think it's a wonderful Halloween book. I mean, like, here we are, Halloween. We definitely did this early morning Halloween. We recorded this.
I will say, I think what makes it a really good Halloween book, and as someone, so admittedly, I feel weird saying we read, because you and I both listen to this on Audible, let's be honest. Yeah. I don't know why we split hairs here. We listen on Audible. And there were times where I'd be listening to it, and it'd be broad daylight, and I would just be so unsettled, because it's a, you know, spoilers, sort of, it's a haunted house book.
Yeah.
And haunted house stuff, to me, always fascinates me. It is one of the things that always scare me. I'm always sort of uncomfortable when I watch haunted house things or read haunted house books. Yeah, I don't believe in any of it. I don't believe in any of, like, ghost stuff. I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in any of that. But somehow, this, like, genre of book always, like, connects with me. It makes me feel so unsettled.
I always have this reoccurring thought when I start any, like, supernatural horror or anything, that I would die in the first opening chapter. I'm the first person to die in these kinds of stories because I'm such a skeptic of things. There's no way that ghosts are real, and then the ghost kills me. And that's how you know ghosts are real. Because I'm not built to survive in a supernatural thing. I'm like, hey, it's all magical bullshit. And I walk down the hallway and then get eviscerated by the predator.
From my perspective, if I were in these books, the book's just about weird noises that happen. Because if I'm that, I'd probably... Well, one or two things. I wouldn't be there. Let's be honest. I'm a coward.
You'd leave immediately.
I would leave immediately. The first time. I don't go even houses that are unsettled yet because it makes that weird creaky sound. I immediately assume I need to leave. I'm $500,000 in debt because I keep buying houses. Because every time my house settles and creaks, I have to leave.
I would go right in that basement. Like, I will prove to you that vampires are not real. Oh, God!
Yeah, from your point of view, it's just a weird sound, and then you die.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into what we love about this book. I like that they're very non-traditional ghosts in this story. Like, without getting into the spoilery side of this yet, they're not exactly ghosts. And in combination with the setting, because it's gothic horror, but, like, the setting is very unique. It's set in Alabama, like, which Southern Gothic is, you would see in Alabama. A lot of times gothic stories, it's an old, creaky, cold setting where this is all on an island right off the coast of Alabama.
Like a pretty island.
Yeah, and it's very hot, and there are multiple houses. Like, so I loved how different, it's not different for different sake, but it's, like, opposite of what you would normally see in the conventions of gothic horror.
Yeah, in my similar vein, in terms of sort of overall, I love the atmosphere of this book. I forever, like, will say that the atmosphere of this book, it builds tension as well as any story I've ever read. And tension in multiple ways without getting any spoiler bits away, because there's sort of two main tensions in this story, and it does a great job of building both of them. And the thing is, when it does kind of go off the rails, like all supernatural books do, you never really know what's going to happen next. There are certain parts in the beginning that definitely follow the story beats. Mm-hmm. You know, you can guess. Character says, hey, don't go into that scary place. And the character, of course, like,
goes to the scary place.
Because otherwise there'd be no story. People always get so mad about, well, why would the character do that? Because if it'd be the most boring book ever, if it was like the logical thing, obviously. Like, that's why no one cares about your life, Jim. no one's entertained by it. Like, I'm sorry. Like, you need people to act stupid and irrational. Otherwise, there's no story. And the thing is, her being the main character without giving too much away is young. So I buy the, well, I guess I'll go in the scary place.
I'm just thinking that there are like 6 or 7 scary books about you that didn't happen. Because the moment something even remotely creepy happen. You were already
gone. I was already gone. I was miles away. Like, I left my wife behind. Like, she's like, and she's just like, what? And it's just, for some reason, like a cartoon puff of smoke. Like, just me.
Like, how many times have you had this situation? So I walked home again, yeah. Steven.
Yeah, just, Steve, it got dark. The street lights were on. It's okay. I'm like, no, there was an ominous black cat across the street. I just had to get out of there.
Like, he was about to cross my path.
But, I just think that, like, I don't know, people get so weird. So one thing I do for this podcast a lot is, after I finish a story, I'll always read a handful of reviews of the book. Just cause it gets me, I like to see, like, sort of what general thoughts are about it. And it's a good way to build my own sort of thoughts. And
yeah, it puts your stuff in context.
But so many of the things I've read was, I didn't like how the character just went. I just don't understand that that's a complaint everyone has about scary movies. Anything that's a critical thought about anything scary, movie, book, whatever. Why'd the character walk into the scary place? I don't know. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a book to read or a movie to watch. Be happy they did it. Thank them for their sacrifice. Thank them like you would thank of like a troop when you see them. Thank you for your service. Because you going into the stupid place, the scary place, and getting yourself into a bad situation, it was very entertaining for me from an outside perspective.
So, this book is also a family drama.
Yeah.
It's generational family drama, to be specific. And I love that element. It's really a thing that McDowell does well, where it's not just... Because, like, it's not uncommon for a haunted house story to have, like, a mom, a dad, and some kids in a strange house. But, like, this setting in this is there are grandparents. There's a really weird father-daughter situation we've talked about. There's aunts and uncles and the family servant, because this is in the South. So, and it's the most progressive 1980s horror book set in Alabama. So, you know, keep that in mind.
I love the main character. I guess I can say her name, India. Yeah. I don't know why it's not, but I'm playing the weird pronoun game. But I like India. I think she's a really fascinating... She's a kid. But I find her... At times, she does not act like a child. Which can be kind of annoying in stories. When a character is... You know, I always say it's that, like, 13 going on 30 syndrome. Mm-hmm. Where the character acts way too mature for their age. And she definitely has components of that. But it actually kind of makes sense in sort of context of her relationship with her dad. Yeah. About why she acts older than she is. But regardless, I find her very fascinating. I mean, I root for her. Like, I really want her to survive. I want her to get out of these situations. And, you know, I think the best thing you can say about any horror movie, like, protagonist is, are you hoping they make it? And if the answer is yes, they did their job.
I think that, like, it sounds more mature than she is, because, like, I think that's a dynamic that you get from a single father figure who isn't really... He's not a bad father, but, like, you could tell that this is somebody making it work.
He's doing his best.
He's not equipped. He was not necessarily equipped at the beginning of this to be a father, but he is a father, and he's going to give it his best.
Give the old college go. Give the old college try.
Do you have any more loves, or do you want to move?
Oh no, I am. So I also you sort of hinted on a little bit. I love the location.
Yeah,
like it's interesting. So when I first started reading this, and I thought haunted house. You'd sort of know, we've all seen Amityville Horror, we've all seen The Conjuring, we've all seen those movies. They're going to go to a house, it's going to be haunted. I freaking just absolutely adore that, one, there's multiple homes. That's cool as hell. Two, it takes place on an island. The island is itself a very interesting setting. And unlike Lost, where it doesn't really make any sense, it actually makes sense here.
Yeah, I mean...
A little bit. Like, it being an island with spooky stuff, you figure out as the sort of the threads get revealed... It doesn't spell anything out by any means, but at least there's like a... I love the fact that the island plays sort of a... You could almost say the island's a separate character. And yeah. I love that. Like, I think it's such a great setting. I'm amazed that islands aren't used more.
Well, I think that, like, the island's called Bell Dam. And I think that Bell Dam is such an interesting thing because it's not an island like... people would normally think, like, out in the middle of the ocean. It's more of a sandbar aspiring to be an island.
Yeah.
Because you can drive to Bell Dam during low tide. The water is down enough that you could just go there. But, like, most of the time, it becomes an island because it's this high spit of dry land that these houses exist. And, like, this is only a story that could be told in the 1980s.
Turns out,
yeah. After global warming, I'm pretty sure it'd be underwater now. That'd be the scariest part of it.
Yeah, that'd be the scariest part, yeah. Always high tide now.
Yeah, perpetual yeah. high tide.
Also, the sort of last thing before we get into the dislikes of this is I really like that the balance of supernatural family drama. Mm. We talk about, I don't want to diss them too much. We've dissed them during our Outsider podcast a little bit. How we always say Dean Koontz books are very much, now this is the detective portion, this is the scary portion, and this is the, you know, whatever portion, and then they're very defined. This does a really, really good job. Even when things are still horrifying, things are going on around them, these characters are still at the mercy of their humanity. And that part of that humanity is they don't get along.
Yeah, I mean, as it turns out, like, because it's a very dysfunctional family. This is the third McDowell book I've read. I don't think he believes in families that aren't profoundly dysfunctional. This group is probably the most functional, which is going to sound really weird when we get to the spoiler side of this, and we get into the synopsis. But I think we can move on into what we don't love about this book. The first thing that I have to point out is it's definitely a very dated book, and I have brought this up a few times already, where it's the most progressive 1980s book, because it's about when this is set. It engages in the magical minority trope real hard.
Yeah.
Like, they have a black servant who, she's paid, she's not a slave.
It'd be weird to have a slave in 1980s.
Yeah, it'd be really illegal, too. And she's a valued member of, like, this family group that everybody respects her opinions. But she is definitely the only one that's being paid to be here. And she definitely makes all the food and cleans the houses. So, there's that.
Yeah, that, and, like, yeah.
And also magic.
Yeah, also magic. That plays a part. My chief complaint overall, I think the book is a good pace, but in the middle bit of the story, I think it really slows. It comes to a screeching halt, and it slows down. I think the problem for me is, and I have this problem with any like sort of, it's kind of like in a video game when you start like doing the main story or the big things and trying to go back and do little side quests. Mm-hmm. I feel like the family drama is great, but at a certain point, your survival instinct should kick in and realize, yeah, I can't really complain about the fact that I don't like my cousin. Like, I got bigger... there are bigger fish to fry here right now.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, the family drama, as much as I like it, whenever some serious supernatural shit is happening, it's like, can we focus on the fact that that just happened?
Yeah, a little more important. Like, I get that you're mad at your grandpa.
Because he's bad. He's terrible.
There's a little more stuff going on here. Let's maybe worry about that. Let's focus on the magic elephant in the room. Like,
yeah, I mean, and this is like early, I was just looking up real quick to double check, and this book came out in 1981. So really, you got that holdover of like that 70s feel into the 1980s.
Well, yeah, I always talk about in my real life that decades never just end. They always carry over. Like, I always joke that in reality, like, the 70s went till about 1984. Mm. Like, in reality, of like what the culture was and sort of like the, you know, the sort of world around it.
Yeah. And like, you get that like feel of the holdover from the 70s into this. It's progressive for what Alabama was at that time. So, you know, not great.
not great.
So, like, I really didn't enjoy the magical minority trope that gets used. And but at the same time, whenever he was writing this, you can't say that, like, it... Well, I mean, it was pretty overused for a while by then, too. But it was sort of just a matter of course at the time. She didn't make it any more right.
I mean, The Shining had a magic, I mean...
Well, there's a reason that this guy was friends with Stephen King.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. That was a thing in fiction, unfortunately, for such a long time. And the problem is, you still kind of see it even today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just white people see other cultures as so different.
More evolved.
Well, I...
No, I mean, honestly, I think that's like the sort of, you know, it's all, it's kind of peak. I'm going to use this in a very, like, I don't want this to come off as jaded. Peak that white liberalism that is very much like, I believe, you know, you see the sign in the front yard, we believe Black Lives Matter, you know, we believe no human is illegal. You see those signs. But then they'll also try to stop low-income housing from being built in their neighborhood because they don't. It's better. Yeah. It's good in theory. You know, I think that's where a lot of this sort of comes from a little bit, where it's like this idea that you mean well, but you're still a victim of your own biases without even realizing it. Yeah. And I think that's where the sort of magical minority sort of trope comes from, is that people are definitely well-intentioned. And, you know, that means a lot, too, being in, your intentions do matter. But I think that, especially for a book in the early 80s, you know, we weren't quite there yet.
Yeah. The other thing that I didn't like about this book, and this is a minor spoiler, so I'm going to get that out there. This is a minor spoiler. You're warned now. They leave the site of the haunting for a little bit.
Yeah.
And
to go work on their grandfather's political campaign.
Yeah. They leave the island for a bit. And they've already talked about how some mysterious supernatural shit is happening. And then just decide to go back. Like, they even have a conversation of like, I think something is working on me that it's just less scary that whenever I'm not there. Like that, none of that works for me. Like this is the only part where like I feel like he just kind of hand waves.
Yeah.
Why they go back?
Like there's nothing really driving them back.
Like other than like, well, we got to finish our vacation.
Yeah, that is. It's funny. So I don't like to ever repeat you, but that's one of mine too. Yeah. So that I found very frustrating. Like there was a point where I think that they leave. It's probably like 2/3 of the way through the story. And
yeah, things have been building.
But stuff's already happened. Yeah. Like, the main character came face-to-face with the thing, and it's, like, scary as hell. And, you know, there's a lot already going on. And characters' lives have already been threatened. But it's funny how, like, it is just, they leave, they go work on their granddaddy's campaign, and they just decide, they go back, and it's so, it literally reads like a Scooby-Doo episode. Like, well, why'd you go back? Well, why not? Nothing else to do. Like,
let's split up.
Like why? Even I remember like listening to this, and it was funny. My wife was at the time, I think she was like reading something, or she was on her computer or something. And I'm literally sitting there, and I'm out loud going, I'm like, I literally go, what the fuck? Like, and when they go, we're going back. Why?
Well, why would you do that?
You know, and I just, that was the same complaint. And not to, you know, dogpile too much, but the other thing I find very odd in this book, and I think it's the thing that I found probably the most, like, just weird. Mm-hmm. So India is a great character. Very, like, she doesn't always act like a kid. Her relationship with her dad is just made me uncomfortable. Like, it's not father-daughter like. And I'm not saying, like, it's anything super weird.
It's not Game of Thrones.
It's not Game of Thrones weird. But it's weird in the sense, like, he like talks about sex with her. He walks around naked. Sunbathes naked.
Which is still as equally as weird.
Yeah.
To find your father out on the beach.
Just naked.
Just nude.
Yeah, that's weird. And then he like, there's a scene where he's, oh, do you want like a downer, which is like a drug? And she's like, no, I don't like what those do to me. Very much implying that they've done drugs together. And she's a teenager. So it just feels like a very, like, honestly, if you told me they were, like, friends, I'd buy it. But the fact that he's her father, and that it does sort of make sense. He's not a guy that's very prepared to be a father, and he's doing sort of the best he can.
Yeah.
But it's still, I'm sorry, fucking weird.
Yeah, it really makes me think, like, how bad was mom? Like, you get a glimpse in this, how bad mom was. Yeah. But, like, it's just one glimpse. Like, I really want to know India's father's name is Lucre. What Lucre's relationship with his ex-wife was like, because he hates her, and clearly she was awful.
Yeah.
But like the fact that he seems like the reasonable, well-adjusted parent between the two, there's a whole story in that.
That's a story I want to read. Why is why is this guy the best you got? Like. I honestly, not to be morbid, the one thing I will say I get about this is, not to be a downer here, I had a rough upbringing.
Yeah.
And I, more than once in my life, have made this joke about my mom, and usually just busting her chops, is I looked at my parents, looked at my mom, looked at my dad, back to my mom, and I went, hello, lesser evil. So, like, I get it. Like, I'm sure from the character of India, she was probably like, well, he's not mean to me or malicious. Yeah, he offers me drugs and he's weird, but beats the alternative.
Yeah, I mean, he's not like a molesting sort of.
No, no, bad. I just think he does. I just don't think he knows boundaries very well.
Yeah, no.
And I think that's just. And the thing is, we all know, you know, we grew up, you know, in, we're children of the 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah.
And we all knew a parent, I'm sure you did too, that was trying to be the cool parent.
Yeah.
And it came off one of two ways. Either you liked it and that was nice, or you thought, oh my God, this person's so freaking annoying and they're weird. I don't like being like this sort of, to me, skates that line of, I guarantee if this was like a high school coming of age story, he'd be the cool dad.
Yeah. I also think that he's the product of, like, you'd have to think that Luker was probably growing up in the 60s, was probably young in the 60s.
He's a child of the 60s, yeah.
And in the 70s, so, like, he was probably a very free love hippie sort, as hippie as somebody who was born in Alabama
could possibly be. Yeah.
I mean, he moved to New York City, and that's why they all kind of, like, find him weird.
Yeah, it's like, true story.
They live in New York City. And that gets brought up several times. But I think we should move on to our spoiler side of this. And I'm going to give you our synopsis of The Elementals. And again, this is your time to tune out, read the book, come back, listen to this again, start at the beginning, listen to all of this again.
Yeah. Seriously, remember, if you complain about spoilers,
like, we're really belaboring the point.
I will make you feel... I'll make you read my teenage poetry.
Oof.
And it's bad.
Oof. I think my stomach just got upset.
Yeah, it ain't great.
I can see that, or the bad Mexican I had earlier. But it's probably your poetry.
It should be.
I refuse to think that I made a mistake.
No, you're perfect. You are without flaws.
Okay, so, synopsis. We start at a rich family's funeral service. Marion Savage had died, and it's the family's custom that their funerals are private affairs, and for good reason. There are two wings of the family through marriage, the McCrays and the Savages. The funeral concludes with the most unsettling family tradition. Marion's children drive a dagger into her corpse's heart to make sure she's dead. It's been a problem before. Soon after, since it's still summer, most of the family head to their private island, Beldam, for their summer vacation, which is the same place Marion had just succumbed to cancer and died. They didn't really care much for Marion, again, for good reasons. She was awful to her two living children, and the third had died in a boating accident near Bell Dam. Noticing a pattern here? So, they weren't too broken up about the whole dagger in the heart business. We, as the audience, spend most of our time with India and her father, Luker, two of the McCrays that are the black sheep of the family because they live in New York City. Initially dubious of spending her summer, you know, on a little coastal island off of Alabama, India is quickly won over by the charm of Beldam. Once there, she questions her father about the third house on the island. Nobody lives there, and it seems to be in the process of being inexplicably consumed by a sand dune. Nobody wants to talk about it with India, and everyone else in the family seems to be okay with the idea of nature or supernatural forces just running its course, slowly destroying the neglected house. Like her father, Luker, who is a professional photographer, India is an avid lover of photography and decides to take it upon herself to take pictures of the third house. Luker has no interest in this and doesn't encourage her to follow through with this plan. He doesn't discourage her either. He just says, I think that's a bad idea, and then goes about his sunbathing. Eventually, the family servant, Odessa, decides to answer some of India's questions about the third house and even helps her to take her pictures. India does defy one of her father's warnings about not climbing up the sand dune to look directly at the house, and it's there she sees something she can't explain, just like he had whenever he was a kid. After that run-in with the possibly supernatural, India avoids the third house for a while. The family settles into a comfortable daily routine, and weeks pass in leisure. Then one day, India's politician grandfather suddenly shows up at Bell Dam and shatters their peace. He comes with the request that they all return home for a few days so they can help him with his campaign. He also wants the savages to sell their stake in Bell Dam, which doesn't go over well with the rest of the family, since India's grandfather also wants to sell their part of the island. Back home, the family is annoyed and decides that they won't go along with this scheme, so India's grandfather takes it upon himself to sneak back down to Bell Dam to burn down the houses, starting with the third house. Of course, at this point, the elementals kill him, and then make it so that no one knows he was ever there and the rest of the when the rest of the family returns for their summer vacation. Shortly after the family returns to the island is when the truly intense supernatural things start to happen. The savage's house is destroyed by sand, again, appearing to come from nowhere, just consuming the mansion suddenly. Convinced that they should leave now, the family is trapped because of high tide, and when one of them gets the bright idea to try to swim across, they find out that the water is boiling. So they're stuck on the island. And finally, they have a showdown with the elementals in the third house, and a couple more family members are killed. However, with newfound insight gained from Odessa in a genuinely grotesque manner of power transference, India manages to help herself, her father, and the remaining family members escape from Bell Dam. And that's roughly what happens.
For me, you really kind of undersell how disgusting the power transfer is in that synopsis. I'm going to say it.
Yeah. No.
It's
you want to share?
I'll reveal it. It's eating eyeballs.
Yeah.
As one does to gain powers to beat an elemental.
Yep.
It's funny. I have a very my bar for things is very high. I've watched a lot of disturbing movies. For some reason, the way it was so matter of fact.
It's like, you gotta eat my eyeballs.
What?
Yeah. I mean, if I die, pluck out my eyeballs
and eat them. Like, imagine, if you will, you're 13 years old. You know, for me, it's my bar mitzvah. And my Yiddish uncle tells me, Stephen, my boy, if I die, you've got to eat my eyeballs. It's the only way. And I'm like,
so you become a man.
I'd be like, Uncle Eugene, I'm not... Okay, I will, but I'm not happy. I'm not happy about it.
What do you think goes well with eyeballs? Like, hot sauce? I think hot sauce goes well with everything.
I mean...
Is it weird for you that I've thought of this?
I would say hot sauce would be the thing that would probably be the...
I think, yeah, with enough hot sauce, yeah, you can get it through anything.
Yeah, or maybe, covered in chocolate sauce or something.
Oh, that's an interesting twist.
Yeah, there you go. Make it sweet.
Yeah, make it a sweet moment.
Yeah.
So let's get into the analysis of this. Yeah. So we touched on this in the early part where we were talking about what we liked about this book. But for Michael McDowell, generational family drama mixed with horror is really his bread and butter. I credit him with getting me to love generational family dramas that aren't horrors. Just in general, I love this form of fiction now, where I like seeing the conflict between not just children and parents, but grandkids and grandparents and all the different generations and aunts and uncles. And because I have a family that is a little bizarre like that. And I think my pet theory is that everybody's family is sort of that, like that. I mean, everybody's got that weird uncle that just... You don't want to talk about that often, but it just everybody knows is not right.
Yeah, I think I think this book, what makes it sort of interesting is that they're a rich family.
Yeah.
And I actually think that kind of before its time, because I think now it's a pretty common trope. Oh, let's show the rich family that hates each other. That's such a very common thing that you see in fiction a lot.
Mm.
And I think this, being what you said was written in 1981, I don't think it really got into that. The idea of a rich family that didn't really get along, is that used to be the trope of the poors. that is a cool sort of component of it. And the family drama for me, the family stuff really serves two points. You know, it's a great indicator of how lost this family is.
Mm-hmm.
And how, even though they're related by blood, they're really not family.
Yeah. The phrase "savage women eat their kids" is a thing that comes up more than once, and It is terrifying, especially because one of the characters is killed by an elemental that takes a form of his mother. And, like, that's a nightmare fuel there.
Not how I'd want to go.
No.
You know, and I think that, listen, the other component sort of that, what makes it interesting is that, like, the family drama really serves the supernatural really well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the supernatural stuff's effective on its own. But because it's happening to these people that are just such a mess, like, I think it's interesting. Like, would the Conjuring movies be as interesting if Patrick Wilson wasn't just so goddamn attractive? Like, you root for him because he's just handsome. But, like, would it be less powerful or more powerful if he was just, like, a 5 out of 10? Like, you know, if he looked like your Uncle Frank. Like, you know, a shirt. He's wearing a large T-shirt, but let's be honest, he moved into XXL territory 10 years ago.
Yeah, and so, like, it's real, real tight.
Yeah, and, like, you know, would that guy, haunted, dealing with haunted houses be more interesting or less interesting? So I like the fact that, like, this family's a mess.
Yeah.
And the thing is, because they're a mess, they're not equipped to sort of handle the haunting stuff, the supernatural stuff. Because, as it turns out, even if you're dealing with something that's a graver threat, we're human beings. We're amazing at still being able to hate our family members, even when there's literal elemental ghosts that doing horrible, horrible shit.
Yeah, it's funny, really, that they're all aware, even from the beginning, that there's something weird about the third house. And they just avoid it. And, like, well, it's definitely a very American problem, where, like, let's just hope that the obvious problem will go away.
Yeah.
And if, like, we just give it enough time, it'll just fix itself. And it doesn't. It just gets worse. It gets profoundly, profoundly worse.
It's funny. This book was obviously set in the 80s. So it doesn't have, but it does have that obvious metaphor of, like, how America deals with things. Like, what about that? Let's just ignore it.
Let's ignore it until it becomes, it kills a few of us.
It's like that I always think of, because everything makes me think of The Simpsons. It's that, let's not listen. Like, that's pretty much, like, it'd be the equivalent of, like, honestly, like, if you woke up one morning and there was, like, a just get out written in blood on your wall, and you decided,
that could mean anything.
That could be anything. That could be a ghost, a huge fan of, that Peele movie.
It could just mean get out of this room.
Or get out of here. Like, get out of here. Maybe
it's a sarcastic thing.
Like a friendly, like, get out.
Get out of here.
Yeah, maybe the Soprano fans, get out of here, like... But, like, I like the fact, though, that this family just does not get along. I find that, to be honestly, like, it's something that I find very comforting, because I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional family, too. I'm oddly comforted by families not getting along, because, my wife's family is amazing, and they all get, for the most part, everyone, even the people they don't, even, like, their problem family members are, like, nice.
They're, like, Disney Channel problem people.
Like, they're just, like, good, like, oh, yeah, he's a little weird. What's he do? He wears flip-flops here. Oh, wow, what a monster.
Yeah.
And he
also wears socks.
With the flip-flops. Yeah, that's actually true. But, like, that actually is exactly
100%. I just, like, pulled that out of
that's 100% true. But so I'm used to, like, the real, like, messed up. When you've got, like, what's messed up? Oh, he went to prison. Like, for a long time. Like, I vibe with, like, the how dysfunctional this family really is.
Yeah.
And how much they don't get along. And even though they're bound by this sort of, like, Southern, they're your blood, you gotta stick with them, they hate each other.
Everybody's so very polite.
Yeah, but they're so polite about it. And I think there's something kind of beautiful about that.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing about the South of the United States. At the least, no matter what they're doing, even if it's objectively terrible, they'll be polite about it.
They'll smile at you.
Yeah, it'll be very smiling. Yeah. But, burning crosses, still...
Still burning crosses.
Still burning cross.
That's the thing about, like, I always say the difference between, like, the South and the North is, like, especially Pittsburgh to me is a great example of this. Pittsburgh is an aggressively, like, ball-busting city. It's kind of like where it's just, like, they'll insult you and they will be happily insulting you. And they'll be mean about it. But, like, the South will be, like, this very friendly looking, but they'll, like, insult you the same exact way, but they'll offer you some sweet tea.
Yeah, at least there's, like, there are pastries and there's like, dessert.
Yeah, that's nice.
Whereas around here, it's just, like, I hate you.
Yeah.
And, like, there's no, do you want to get a beer later?
No, it's just, I hate you.
I just hate you. So, moving on to the next point I want to bring up is, One of the things that I love about this book is it has a real sensitivity for, because gothic horror is a subgenre of horror, and he clearly knows the standard conventions, because he does the opposite of a lot of them. And, like, you have to know what they are to do the opposite. He's not just doing things different for different sake. And what I mean by that is, like, we talked about earlier how Beldam is very hot. Normally in gothic horror, he'd be very cold and wet. It's very dry, Beldam. Despite being an island, it's always dry and everything sort of described that way. And another thing that happens in gothic horror a lot is whenever people are moving into the scary mansion or the scary castle or whatever, it's a mystery, and it's the setting itself is an unknown quantity. And what I think that is really the most horrifying thing is they have been going to this island for generations. This has been their family vacation for every summer for countless years.
You're talking like 70, 80, 90 years. It's an insane amount of time.
Like, and this is, it's familiar to them. And it's their, people have slept there, lived there, had parties there. They felt comfortable there, looked forward to going there. And then one day, it turns on them. It's like if you're the family dog, as much as you love them, I love my dogs, just one day decided, I'm going to murder you. Not like joking, it's just turns on you and just tries to kill you. And it's that level of fear, like this unexpected like thing that like you were comforted by, is by the end of the book is out to get you.
I think that so much of this book, it's sort of this generational ignoring problems until they become inescapable. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, this is set in the 80s, but you could, again, we brought it up earlier, climate change is a great example of this, of older generations choosing to just ignore this obvious thing. Like, to me, the most fascinating part of this story, legitimately, is when India sees the creepy thing.
Yeah.
And immediately is scared and says, Dad, I saw this really creepy thing in the third house. Oh, I saw that when I was a boy. And I chose to ignore it. Like, we should all do. Let's just ignore it. And, like, to me, there's something sort of very poetic about this idea that you ignore problems until there's no way you can ignore them anymore. You know, that's what this sort of story is that the supernatural thing was fine when it was just sort of these slight scare, you know, a little scary, but it's whatever. There's no way it's going to get worse.
We just don't go into that house anymore.
Yeah.
There are three mansions on this tiny, tiny little sandbar, and we just live in two of them now.
And then eventually, like anything, the problem becomes you can't ignore it anymore. And the consequence is mass death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that that's sort of the overarching, that's really the main theme of the story, is the sins of the past catching up and ruining the future.
Like, a lot of people don't make it through this.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the McCrays and most of the McCrays make it, but the Savages get really savage.
The Savages get really, yeah. It doesn't work out well for the Savages.
Grandpa McCray, he's the politician. He gets killed by the baby monster, mm-hmm. which... it's as terrifying as you might imagine it is. Read the book and you'll get that it's worse.
It's somehow worse than being a baby monster.
Like,
it made me legitimately, like, uncomfortable.
Like, I am so impressed with how McDowell just comes up with, like, bizarre monsters. And what I... the one missed opportunity, I think, that, like, whenever he describes the elementals is they reveal that they're not really ghosts. They feel more like an alien presence, but he never really explores that. They just are. They, yeah. like, weren't, oh, great-granddad Savage or great-grandma McCray died and became an elemental. No, they just always were, and
they always will be.
Yeah, and they take bizarre forms, like, they're, at one point, the one character describes looking in, and the elementals were like took the form of these old men playing a game of poker or cards or whatever, and they didn't have any legs. They're like, no reason to do that other than creepy. Like, and they weren't like family members or any other. They were just decided we're going to be old men who play poker today.
Yeah, and I think what makes this such an effective story is that you don't learn much about the elementals. And I think that it's like the Michael Myers effect. It's much scarier when you don't understand the monster. the moment you start explaining bit by bit, like, oh, he's from Canada and he played Austin Powers, like, the moment you start learning things, the moment you start learning things about the monster, it becomes way less scary. So, like, I like the fact that you never really get any background information on the elementals.
Yeah, I love that truly alien feel about them. They're supernatural, you know that. But, like, their rhyme or reason or why they do what they do is unknowable. Because they aren't ghosts in the traditional sense. It's not like they have unfinished business. They just seem to be around to fuck with people.
They enjoy it.
And yeah, that it's not like they're tortured into doing this. They just, this is just what they do.
You know, sometimes you just enjoy it. It's important to find what you like, what you do, and enjoy. If you enjoy it, do it.
The last thing I want to bring up in this section in our analysis is I read in... I didn't come up with this on my own, so I'm not going to take credit for it, but I read in the introduction to this book, written by somebody else, is in one of the paperback editions, that India McCrae is really a prototype to Lydia Dietz from Beetlejuice, which I thought was fascinating, and it changed the entire book for me, because I just kept seeing, because they're both photographers, and McDowell worked on the screenplay for Beetlejuice, which you could definitely see a lot of how Lydia got her weirdness from, was born from this story. Luker doesn't make it into Beetlejuice, because she was a weird kid with these two aggressively normal parents, but like, I feel like in The Elementals, it makes much more sense that India's a weird kid because she's raised here by a weird guy.
Yeah.
Like, that's my final bit for the analysis.
Yeah, and my sort of, like, closing point about sort of... I just want to say I love this story. Mm. You know more about the author than I do, but this is my first exposure to him. And I just love so much how he manages to be so creepy that it can be broad daylight and you're reading this or listening to it, and you'll assume... My house was not that old, and I'm now wondering, what the hell's going on here? What's the story about my... Like, it makes you sort of feel like what... It makes you just unsettled.
What is under the surface of everything.
And I love the fact that, again, it just really hammers home the sins of the past will come back to haunt the future.
Well, I think we can move into our parting thoughts before we sign off and let you get back to candy and passing out candy and stealing candy from kids this Halloween, because it is definitely Halloween when we did this. Don't listen to any of this.
No, it's all Halloween.
Pre-record these things.
Who pre-records things?
Now,
who would do that? So many people would do that. I would never do that.
We stayed up at midnight the day before. It's 1 a.m. We're both bloodshot, staring at each other across... I don't know. I'm getting off topic. But the last thing I wanted to bring up is that... So McDowell worked on a few things that everybody knows about. Nightmare Before Christmas, he worked on the screenplay for that. He worked on Beetlejuice. And he worked on other things in film and I believe TV as well. But we remember Tim Burton for both Beetlejuice and Nightmare Before Christmas. And Tim Burton famously did not direct Nightmare Before Christmas. That he was the producer on that. And that's just one of those things that every snooty person like me brings up. But McDowell really did write a lot of that. And like, it's fascinating to go back and watch those movies. And you can see, if you're familiar with any of McDowell's novels, you can see the little things, like the family drama elements that he works into all of the anything he ever touched. But I think that, like, one of the and this is a downer, the reason that we don't really remember McDowell is he died in the 90s from AIDS because he was gay. And, like, he was gay and he died of AIDS, and at the time we were not very sympathetic to that sort of thing, because AIDS in the 90s was something that only happened to promiscuous gay men. And say what you will about Tim Burton, but he didn't die of AIDS in the 90s. And it's not fair, but I think, like, there's a certain amount of... We remember our directors more than we remember our screenwriters. But I think there's an ugly undercurrent of we don't remember McDowell because he was gay.
Yeah, and I think that's just a sad, that's a real sad sort of commentary of, we talk about the sort of progression of like being progressive. Mm. This book's progressive for the 80s, and you know, this is progressive for the 90s, and so on, so on and so forth. But there's a certain level of sadness for, like, we should have known better. Like, you know, there was science behind in the 90s that we knew that, like, you know, AIDS wasn't a promiscuous disease. It wasn't a gay disease. We should have known better. And it makes you sad. I think that's, in my sort of parting thoughts, not really related to that at all, is that reading this and sort of being a little bit familiar via conversations with you about his sort of history, and it makes you realize that, like, I really respect people that turn their pain into art. Mm-hmm. And you can tell there's elements of that. I don't know anything about his backstory. I have no idea. He maybe had a great family, but based on what you've told me, I'm guessing he didn't. And I'm very impressed by the way he manages to sort of turn that pain into a really good story and just a really good book. That, to be honest with you, like, you know, I'm not the big, I've said before, I'm not the biggest like Stephen King fan. I'm not the biggest, you know, I love horror movies. I love scary things, but just this connected with me in a very like deep way, because I sort of understand family drama and I understand sort of what it's like to be buried by your past a little bit. And I really just admire where this sort of book went. And I think that it hits so many good notes. And I would tell anyone that wants to read this, like, be prepared to not only have a scary book that will make you feel very unsettled, but will make you sort of think about your own family and make you think about your own sort of sins. Mm-hmm. And because that's the sort of thing here. It really is a book about stuff coming to bite you in the ass because you choose to ignore for too long. And that's a perfect metaphor for, honestly, how AIDS even was. Because people that died of AIDS in the, you know, the 70s and 80s and 90s, a lot of times, just ignored it.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. The last thing I want to shout out is how I discovered Michael McDowell and how I've pressured all of my friends, including Stephen here, into reading his stuff, is a great publishing house called Valancourt Books. They really revived, because they're behind the audiobook, and they're behind all the Kindle versions, and they're doing reprints of all, because a lot of his stuff was like pulp horror. Like, they wrote it, they published it, it was originally published on cheap paper, and those books really rarely exist now anymore. But Valancourt Books really breathed second life into him as an author. They produced his masterwork, which is called Blackwater, as one big audiobook. So in Valancourt is interesting if you're if you want to get into more LGBTQ fiction and horror, they're a great publishing house to look at. So I wanted to give a big shout out to them because they have introduced me to all kinds of people I just didn't know existed.
And that's kind of the best way, I think, to end this. That's a perfect sort of way to go, is that, like, there's so many talented people out there that just don't get remembered for so many, like, bias and horrible reasons. And it's nice to see a little bit of recognition to somebody that honestly deserves more acclaim and more credit for being influential than they're definitely given.
Yeah. So, happy Halloween. Get out there. Scare people.
Eat some candy.
Eat that candy. Have a good night. We'll see you next month.